This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done remarkable things for the sake of our freedom, and who maybe, if we hear their stories, we don't take as much for granted ourselves. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifices. We want to make sure their stories are preserved so we don't forget the price paid for our freedom. And along the way, we always learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained, oftentimes inspired. And I'm sure that'll be the case today with 91-year-old Frank Rigo of Phoenix, Arizona, originally from Prescott, Arizona, a little north of here. And we're going to hear a little bit also before we're done about the Paralyzed Veterans of America, because he's one of them. It didn't happen in the war. It happened afterwards, but we'll get that story. Let's start early on. Growing up in Prescott, Arizona, you had three brothers, two sisters. Both your parents were Italian immigrants. What was life like? What were your big plans for life as a boy growing up in Prescott?
Well, it was it came sudden on me. I was in high school, and from high school, I went in the service. Didn't have much time to plan anything.
It seems like everybody has a memory of that, how they heard that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you got that news?
I was working in a grocery store at that time while I was going to school. And I remember on that, it was a Sunday afternoon, and we were making sausages. And we were tying sausages into links like Brocksworth. I remember just as vivid today as it was then when Roosevelt said, "I have declared war on the Japanese." And the Japanese were here visiting. They did the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor while they were here in Washington, D.C.
For a teenager to hear that news, was that a big deal? I mean, did that rock your world a little bit? What did that mean to you at the time?
It meant we were going to go to war, and it wouldn't be long, we'd be gone. And I graduated in June of 42, and in January of 43, I was in the service.
But before that, you found another way to contribute to the war effort, because down in San Diego, they were building B-24s, and you got some experience with that. You worked in the Consolidated Aircraft Plant. What'd you do on those B-24s?
On the B-24s, I worked on the wings. We were building the spar for the wing, and the wing was basically a flying gas can, and that's where they put all the fuel in it. And I wanted to be a gunner in the belly of one of those B-24s, but ended up going to pilot school, and then when they had so many pilots, I went into radio from there.
And before that, while you were still at the B-24 factory, I think this is interesting. The manufacturing effort in World War II was how fast they produced all these airplanes. And we've heard about Willow Run in the Midwest and how quickly they turned out these plane parts. But you got some of those parts in San Diego, and they didn't fit quite right. Tell us what you had to do to those wings that came from Willow Run to make sure they actually would attach on those B-24s.
The wing was an eighth of an inch too long to where they couldn't use the flaps. So I was on a stool that had three casters on it with a drill motor grinding the eighth of an inch off the trailing edge of that wing. And we were working 12 hours a day, no Sundays off, 7 days a week. And I did that for about 3 months. We had about 120 of those wings that were shipped from Willow Run to San Diego that were an eighth of an inch too wide. And instead of junk them, we made them fit.
Grinding down wings all day long, I'm sure that noise would get tired, the vibrations you'd get tired of. What did you think about when you're doing that hour after hour after hour?
I was getting paid, and it was a job. And I was a young kid, not knowing any better, and so that's what it amounted to, and it was great to get it.
Well, and I guess if you guys didn't do that, then there were some B-24s that weren't going to get made, and there were some pilots and crewmen who weren't going to have a plane to fly, huh? I mean, is it as simple as that?
That's as simple as that. It was, we were cranking them planes out in 3 or 4 days sometime.
And so you kind of gave us the scoop there. You wanted to fly after that experience in the aircraft factory. You went to pilot training. They had enough pilots. They turned you into a radio and radar man. You did end up going overseas. Before we get to your experiences, I'm just curious. You had three brothers. Did any of them end up serving in the war as well?
All three of them served. My youngest brother served in the Korean War, and my older brother served in England. The other brother worked at the proving grounds in California there, where Yeager did all the flying and everything. Oh. Mojave, uh-huh. He spent his time up in Mojave.
So your mom had four boys that were in the service. She must have done a lot of praying, huh?
I lost my mom in 38 with double pneumonia, so she was up there watching over me, I guess.
So tell me about your adventures. What kind of training did you go through? What are the things that you learned in the Army Air Corps?
From pilot school, then I went to radio school, radio and radar, to repair. Then when I went overseas, we were in a communication department with the guerrillas in the Philippines. I was on my way to invade Sasebo, Japan, when they dropped the second bomb and the Japanese gave up.
Good thing they dropped the second bomb, and you didn't have to do that because you might not be here talking to me. You're talking about the Philippines and working with those guerrillas. This is the 37th Fighter Control Squadron. What did that mean? Who were you communicating for? What did that squadron consist of?
We were also working with them, mainly fighter planes, P-38s, P-47s, get in contact with them, and like landing and everything like that. It was a variety of different jobs. With our radar, we could find where the enemies were at also. It worked both ways, keeping track of ours and keeping the enemy in check to see where keep them away from the troops.
So give me a taste, if you can, of one of those days for you. You go in, you're in an office somewhere in the Philippines. Where were you in the Philippines?
In the tent. That was the office, the tent. In the Philippines, it was sort of winding down, and they were cutting back on a lot of things. They used to call them DF vans with all the equipment in it. When we moved on, we had to couldn't take them with us, so we had to destroy them so nobody could get a use them against us.
Today, we say radar. Everybody knows what that is. In fact, some people are saying, oh, that's what that cop holds up when he pulls me over with the speeding ticket. But back in 1944, 1945, radar was a pretty new thing. Was it kind of a neat adventure for you to get in on the ground floor of radar and get to figure out how this thing worked? And tell us what it was like. How would you operate that system?
Well, I'll never forget one time in the Korean War, the radar picked up an identified object, and we scrambled some fighters to go intercept. We were up at Mather Air Force Base next to Sacramento, and we found a flock of geese flying at 11,000 feet, and the radar picked up the pilot, said it's a flock of geese, but we picked them up on radar flying.
Wasn't a UFO. No conspiracy theories there, just a bunch of honking geese. But so during World War II, when you're using this radar equipment, what would you see, and how could you tell what was what? Can you describe for us how that worked or how you carried out your job?
Tubes on those units then were round, and you had a hand that went around just like an hour hand on a clock, and the planes would show up as a blip on the tube, and that's how we could keep track of who was where. And then we had a height finder where we could tell how high the plane was flying.
How could you tell if a plane was American or Japanese or something else? Was there any way to tell?
The only way you could tell that back then was to know where our planes were at, and there's something in the sky that wasn't supposed to be there. According to our records, then it was an enemy.
But from the radar display itself, there is no differentiation. A blip is a blip, whether it's American or Japanese. So it sounds like there was probably a fair amount of guesswork or just logical conclusions you had to make.
Well, that's true, but you also knew where yours were supposed to be at.
Were there ever some tense moments for you over there where you felt like maybe people's lives depended on what you were doing or what message you relayed or how you handled the situation?
Back then, you didn't think about the thing. You just thought, well, let's do the best you can to save as many as you could. You don't have time to think about it.
What part of the Philippines was that? Which island were you on?
Going to the Philippines, I landed at Luzon, then went up to Clark Field, spent my time at Clark Field. Weather, when those typhoons come by, you really know they're coming by.
Well, it sounds like there's some stories there. What do you remember about those typhoons?
You see a breeze blowing and everything gets just as still as can be. and that you know that within 15, 20 minutes, you're going to be blown away if you don't get in a hole or something. You're going to get wet, too.
So you guys had some holes dug or some shelters you'd get into or what?
You never knew where you were going to be at when they came. And so you just did the best of what you had.
And what goes through your mind when you're hunkered down like that waiting for this thing to pass? I mean, I can't imagine what that feels like.
Well, it's you don't have time basically to think about it. You just do what you can do best for the moment.
And you mentioned when you first described going overseas for that duty that you did some coordinating with Filipino guerrilla troops that were fighting alongside Americans.
There was a lot of Filipinos that came with them along with the American forces. They just grabbed a gun and came along.
You were coordinating with these air forces, but you also had to know where the ground troops were and what areas were held by Americans, what areas might not be. What kinds of things were you doing there?
They were just trying to find the movements of the troops, where the concentration was. If it needed bombs, they could go bomb them.
Well, and you mentioned bombs. Did it ever occur to you that where you were might be a target, that you could come under enemy attack?
You're never free of that. You were vulnerable just as they were from us. Where I was at, I never did get that close except for some Japanese that would sneak in. And basically, they weren't sneaking in to hurt us. They were sneaking in to try and get food.
Were you getting a sense that the war was winding down, that the Allies were close to a victory? I mean, did you have a feeling that that was going to happen? Or were you thinking, hey, we're going to have to go invade Japan?
I was on my way to invade Japan, and I was sailing by Okinawa on LST on the way to Japan when they surrendered. So I don't know what would have happened. Probably wouldn't be here because we landed in Sasebo, and there was just the hillside was full of caves. They would just shoot us like ducks in a rain barrel.
So that's where you ended up landing after the surrender, but that's the same spot you guys would have landed had there been an invasion?
Same spot. So might not be here today for with hadn't surrendered.
So I guess you applauded President Truman for making that decision to drop the bomb?
It's a terrible bomb, but it did the job.
So you were there in Japan for a good couple months then, huh?
They put us on a train and took us to Tokyo, and I sailed out of Tokyo Bay coming home. And I went through Hiroshima.
Well, that was my question. If you were over there in Japan for that long, you must have seen some things. What did you see there? And what did it do to you to look at that complete devastation?
Hiroshima, sometime right here, they tear a house down and haul all the rubbish away and rake the lot, and it's flat and clean after demolishing a house. That's what the whole city of Hiroshima was like. When I went through it, they put new tracks for the trains, but there was nothing left. You never thought that there was a city, that there was nothing left.
Was that difficult to look at for you emotionally? Did it weigh on you to see that?
Well, you didn't give it a thought, you know. Like I say, everything was just swept clean. There was no rubbish or anything because it all burned up. They say the city was there, but there was no more city, no street. There was no signs of any streets or fire plugs or anything. It just was wiped clean, burned off the face of the earth.
People my age have grown up our whole lives knowing about that and knowing that that was possible. But I imagine for someone like you to see that and realize, wow, there's something that can do this, that can just obliterate an entire city like that, that had to be eye-opening or kind of shocking. Do you remember processing that this is even possible?
I was thinking I was real fortunate that they surrendered, or I wouldn't have been on that train heading for Tokyo. And so I was young, and I didn't give that much consideration to think, it's possible that they could blow the whole city off the map.
I can sure see how that would stick with you. We need to catch our first commercial break here, but there's much more to come on today's program. We're going to wrap up Frank's World War II experience and then let him explain how he became involved with the Paralyzed Veterans of America. Back to Frank Rigo's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.